We come tonight to the arrival of the Israelites to Mount Sinai. This really is a special chapter in the Bible. You know, I say that often. I say that about a lot of stories. I say that about a lot of things that God does and places where God does something to change the course of human history. I want to say tonight that Mount Sinai is very, very important to the story of God and man. Mount Sinai is important. It's an important place of meeting with God. It's an important place for us to understand some things about the nature of God. And especially, Mount Sinai to me, and this part of the Bible, and I'll talk about it in a few minutes, represents the holiness of God and what we understand about the doctrine of holiness. You might think, boy, I've never thought about Mount Sinai as being a place or a part of the doctrine of holiness, the doctrine of entire sanctification, but I love this chapter. And to me, it says something, at least to me, about our doctrine and why holiness is important to God. And why this mountain was such an important place in the history of the Jewish people. Mount Sinai, as you know, is a dear place to the Jewish people. It's also a dear place to Christian people and those that affirm the importance of the law of Moses. And so tonight I want to read this chapter. It's a long chapter, 25 verses, and I'm going to read it in its entirety. If you want to follow it along, I invite you to, or you just kind of want to sit back and listen to it. And then I want to talk to you really about the importance and the emerging doctrine of holiness and where we see it in this story, and at least as I think about it. Exodus chapter 19, going to read the entire chapter. In the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on the very day they came to the desert of Sinai, after they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you fully obey me and keep my covenant, then all out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." Did you hear that? That last paragraph? "These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful that you do not go up the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up to the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us, put limits around the mountain and set it apart as holy. The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up with you. But the priest and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them. Wow. This is a chapter that describes a very special place. A chapter that describes something different and unique than God's people had ever experienced before. God was revealing himself in a unique way. God was revealing himself in a personal way of connection to the people and reaching out to them to say, I want to be your God. And I want you to be my people. I want you to be set apart for me. And through you to bless the whole earth. Mount Sinai is the place where God begins, I think, to reveal himself in a different way, in a new way, in the fullness of a way, in the way of holiness and specialness and connection. Mount Sinai, a holy mountain. You may know that Mount Sinai is in the southern peninsula, or the Sinai Peninsula. The Sinai Peninsula is that area today that's kind of between Egypt and Israel. Belongs to Egypt now because it was conceded to them in territory. This area of land that looks like a triangle, that's the Sinai Peninsula. It's a wilderness area. I had the opportunity when I went to Israel a few years ago to arrange for a trip to Cairo. Across the Sinai Peninsula is about a 3-hour drive, a road that goes across. But at the time, because it was unsafe to be in that area, I paid a driver to drive me down to the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula and up around the other side and into Egypt and toward Cairo, to where we had an opportunity to visit in Cairo. It was desert land. It was wilderness. There wasn't anything green that I remembered seeing in the Sinai Peninsula. Now, there may have been, because we left and it started to get dark about halfway through the trip. It was actually a 9-hour drive the way that we went, instead of a 3-hour across, and it took a long time to get there. It ended up being through the night, and we ended up getting there about 6 in the morning. But when we could see, it was a desert, it was a wilderness place. Mount Sinai is the highest mountain in the Sinai Peninsula. There are other mountains that are approaching it, but Mount Sinai is the highest. There's another mountain very close to it that also is about the same height, but about 500 feet lower than Mount Sinai. So Mount Sinai, if you're looking at this mountain, it's 7,497 feet above sea level. So you think, well, how tall is a mountain like that? Well, I looked up how tall is Jack's Mountain. Most of you know where Jack's Mountain is. Jack's Mountain is almost exactly one-third of the height of Mount Sinai. So if you look out at our Pennsylvania mountains, they're, you know, most of them are about the same height around here. And look out there and then imagine three times that high is the height of Mount Sinai. And so it could be seen from a long way away. Not quite like the mountains out west that you can see for 100 miles at times, but certainly you could see it from across the Sinai Peninsula and around there. The mountain itself has always been seen as a holy place. Even during and before this time, there's records of Mount Sinai as being a special place, probably because it was the highest mountain in the area. And so it's kind of been a mountain that's been revered in many ways. And obviously it has been for Christians and for Jewish people as the place where God has met his people. Now, I do want to say in passing that there are actually two places that claim to be Mount Sinai. I don't know for sure, but there is a place across the other, I'll show you on a map in a few minutes, across the Red Sea that some claim is a place of Mount Sinai. For what I want to talk to you about tonight, I'm saying that I believe it was in the Sinai Peninsula. This is a map of that. And if you look at this map, I want to show you some things about it here. I guess I should stay close to the microphone a little bit if so you can hear. But this right here is the Sinai Peninsula. Over here is Jerusalem. Right up here in the corner in the Dead Sea is this body of water. And this whole area is wilderness. It's dry. Over here is Ramesses, Succoth, and Pithom. Present-day Cairo in this area. But the Israelites would have traveled from this area somewhere down here, perhaps across this body of water that was called the Red Sea then. Now it's called the Gulf of Suez. It's the Suez Canal now. And then they would have traveled in this wilderness area down to this place right here called Rephidim. I know you can't see that. And then about 18 to 20 miles south and a little bit east of Rephidim is Mount Sinai. So you see the distance from here to here, I understand, is about 400 miles. So it's a long way, and the Israelites traveled over 3 months to get to the place of Mount Sinai. And we're going to read a little bit about the timing of that. So you have Rephidim. Last Sunday night, we talked about the battle at Rephidim, that was the first battle and the great battle the Israelites had, their first enemy that attacked them, the Amalekites, and how the Amalekites came down from, the Amalekites basically controlled all this area. So when the Israelites were coming down here, they would have known about them, and they got down here to Rephidim. And then the Amalekites brought their army down and attacked them at Rephidim. And then last week we read about what happened to the Amalekites and that God gave the Israelites a great victory. As long as Moses was holding up the rod, then there was a great victory over the enemy. As soon as his arms got tired, then the battle went the other way. And so two men held up his arms in order for the battle to be won for the Israelites, and it did. And so you have this peninsula, you have the Israelites winning this great battle, and then God brings them to the place of Mount Sinai, and where they encounter God in a marvelous way. You would say also that the Battle of Rephidim was a time of learning to rely on God, and for them to see what God had done. And the idea that Moses had to have his arms lifted up to heaven was so that he would know and the people would know that it's God that's winning the battle and not the people. Because without God, without relying on him, then for sure the Amalekites were stronger, had more people, had a greater army. And so they learned to rely on God here. And then after this battle at Rephidim, then they traveled to where we come to the text in chapter 19 and to Mount Sinai. Again, about 18 or 20 miles. Okay, so they will be in the area of Mount Sinai for a long time, about 11 months. To be exact, 11 months and 20 days, The Israelites will be at Mount Sinai. You may wonder in your Bible, well, how much of the first five books of the Bible cover the time that they are at Mount Sinai? And it's very easy to tell from Exodus chapter 19 to the end of the book. They're at Mount Sinai. They're at Mount Sinai all through the book of Leviticus. And then they're at Mount Sinai from the first chapter of Numbers through the 10th chapter, about halfway through it. At verse 11, they move on. And so if you're wondering in your Bible how long and what they did and why is Mount Sinai so significant, just look at the amount of text of the Bible is given toward their time at Mount Sinai. All of this is about Mount Sinai. It's about what God said to them. It's about what happened there, kind of good and bad. 11 months and 20 days they were there. They were there long enough for Moses to receive the fullness of the law. They were there long enough for the people to grow restless and talk Aaron into fashioning a golden calf and to be punished by God for that. They were there at Mount Sinai long enough for God to give the plan to build the Ark of the Covenant, to build the tabernacle. So all during those 11 months and 20 days, God was giving to them the instructions about each of these things. It says at the verse 1 of chapter 19, in the third month, on the very day the Israelites left Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai. So how long was it? They came out of Egypt, they came across the Red Sea, and then 3 months to the point now that they receive the law on Mount Sinai. And then when you're looking at Numbers chapter 10, verse 11, it says, on the 20th day of the second month of the second year. So it's really easy to put together the chronology and the time. Sometimes people think the Old Testament is just full of all these vague things. Nobody knows how they're all connected, but it's not true. The Old Testament is very connected time-wise, space-wise, where the people were at, what they were doing. And so you have this amount of time. From Exodus chapter 19 to Numbers chapter 10, you have this encampment in the third month, it says. Well, what I want to say about Mount Sinai, among other things, is how special to God these things were. And we know it because what he said about it. The mountain was special. The mountain was holy. There was something about that mountain that God said was to be different in their hearts and their minds. They weren't to treat it like another mountain. They weren't to treat it like all the desert around them. They were to realize that God's presence was uniquely attached to Mount Sinai. They were to understand that. They were to look to that. They were to see that. They were to be careful about that. They were to be very cautious about how they treated Mount Sinai itself. When to go up, when not to go up, who was to go up, who was not to go up, when they were to respond, and how they would respond to this infinite God. This is the beginning of man trying to respond to the holiness of God, trying to understand who God is. You might say to me, this is the beginning of God's people trying to connect with God, trying to connect with this awesome, infinite, eternal God that you cannot see. Here on Mount Sinai, they are beginning to try to do that. And God is reaching down to man. He's trying to connect to the heart of man. He's trying to begin a relationship that will continue through time and lead up to the coming of Jesus. When God becomes flesh and dwells among us, at this time he doesn't do that yet. His presence is on Mount Sinai. His presence is in the law of Moses, it's called, or the law of God, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible that expresses God's laws for man. For his people, his specific people, the Israelite people, the descendants of Abraham, those who had come through Egypt, and now God has promised them the land that they are to live in. And descendants of Abraham, too numerous, as stars in the sky, the law was God's gift to them. The law is God's holiness that he gives to his people to help his people to be holy, so that the people would understand how they would respond to him, how they would live their lives so that they would respond to this infinite, awesome God, and how were they to live with their brothers and their sisters? How were they to live in the new land? What were the principles and the commandments that they were to live by the land that they received and the work that they did and the marriages and the sexual relations and what they did about the idols that were in the land and all those things. God gave the law to as his loving covenant to them. My Old Testament professor in seminary loved to talk about the law. He loved to talk about the covenant and that it wasn't a restrictive code of ethics that were to be pressed on the people that they had to live by. It was God's loving covenant. This is how you live. This is how you enjoy life. This is how you understand who I am. Understand my law. Understand the way that I think. Understand the way that I express love and guidance and helpfulness. The law was given to the people so they could understand the holiness of God. It wasn't to be a list of do's and don'ts and that wasn't the core. The core of it was relationship with God, because he's a holy God and he wants a relationship with you. The law is special. I know that maybe we throw that term around sometimes in the church today. The law, well, the law was the Old Testament, you know, or, you know, the law was that. But actually the law is and will always be the heart of God and how he expressed it in our culture. And in our day of changes that happen through humanity, we don't look at it the same way as the Israelite people, as the covenant descendants of Abraham did then. Surely we look at that different today, but if we miss the purpose of the law, that it was a loving relationship that God was trying to give to the people to establish relationship, then we miss how important and special the law is. The law was holy, holiness in the law. The tabernacle. We think about the meaning of that temporary structure that could be taken up and rolled up in the canvas and taken to another location and then opened back up and all the places put in certain order, and everything about that tabernacle was saying something about the holiness of God for then. We don't have a tabernacle now like that. In fact, we know that the temple of the Holy Spirit is not a building. It's not a church. It's not stained glass windows. It's not padded pews and air conditioning on a Sunday night. The tabernacle of the Lord is you and me. But back then, this is how they began to understand that. First, they had to understand the presence of God. And then God would somehow be willing and able to manifest his presence to them. And they could see somehow physically that God existed. He was real and alive and powerful. So the tabernacle, God gave them the plan for the tabernacle and said, build this tabernacle and this will be a special place and I will come down to the tabernacle and I will meet with you. So you have these visions of smoke and fire, as was through the Red Sea and following the pillar, and all these visions of the presence of God on Mount Sinai and in the law and in the tabernacle and then the Ark of the Covenant. Again, this physical box that God gave a specific plan to build. And it had to be certain dimensions and certain materials, and everything had to be certain and exact. And if we ever do read this part of it, that everything about the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle is to be exact. Why is that? Because God is inflexible? No. It's because God is holy and to be set apart, and we're to see him uniquely in a special way. We're not to take him for granted. We're not to loosely listen to what he tells us to do, but what he says to us. And even in the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle was special. And so we see this holy God reaching down for relationship with his people. And this to me is somewhat of the beginning of that, of how we see God. Then you have the covenant, the idea of the covenant. And what God says in this, looking specifically in chapter 19, look at what God says about the covenant. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain. This is what you're to say to the house of Jacob. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt. You yourselves have seen that, God says to the people. You know what I did in Egypt. You know I sent Moses to you. You know I gave him a rod with power in it to turn the river blood and to bring upon Egypt the plagues. You know on the Passover night, I told you the plan. I told you, you saw what I did. Then you saw what I did when you got up to the Red Sea. You saw what I did when Moses lifted up that rod and the waters parted and I went through. And the people went through. Look at Egypt, he says. You know what I did in Egypt. And then he says, and you know how I carried you on eagle's wings. What a beautiful phrase. Just imagine the female eagle. I've heard that this would have been an expression that's used because of the beauty and the wonder of the female eagle and the breath. I'm not sure I know all about this picture that we have here, but I read a little bit about it and how the eagle's wings represented the strength of God. How God says, I carried you just like that eagle. You were riding on me. What a beautiful picture. And then as I stopped and read twice earlier, you're my treasured possession. I mean, God just lays it out here. You know, if it was, we were talking in terms of romance, you know, it's like the boyfriend saying, honey, I just love you completely. I want you. God says, I want you. You're treasure to me. Of all the people on earth, of all the people, all the tribes, all the nations, you are my treasured possession. I want you for relationship. And through you, I want to reach out to all those people and for them to understand who I am. Understand that I want relationship. And he says, you will be mine. All through the whole earth is mine. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The covenant, God's making that declaration to them. I want you for my relationship. I want you. You know, in the same way that in the New Testament days, Jesus says, I want you. God says, I'm calling to you. Peter preaches in the book of Acts the call that God gives on us because he wants us. You will be mine. And then in the other side of the covenant, the other side of the covenant is if you obey me fully. He says in verse 5, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then, if then, out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. God says to them, you've got to keep your side of it. I've given you what you need to hold on. You know, holiness involves the two-sided relationship, the two-way relationship, the covenant and all those things. When I studied the book of Leviticus, I was amazed by what it said about the holiness of God. When I was in seminary, I took a class about this part of the Old Testament. And I was given a topic to write about holiness in the book of Leviticus. It's the longest paper I wrote in seminary. I got so into the idea of covenant relationship and what the covenant means with God that it really described for me who God is. He's a God that reaches out to us. And in the law, he's giving us his loving protection. He's giving us his loving plan in order to help us to live the way that he wants to. God is to be set apart in our minds and our hearts. He is to be highly honored in the Old Testament in these ways, but then in the New Testament sense too. Jesus gave more fullness to the idea, and Paul wrote about it, and he said, we're now the living sacrifices. You went through the law, and then the sacrificial system, and then Jesus came to fulfill all of that. He came so that we would become those living sacrifices to him, holy and acceptable to him. He is to be honored. You think of the first four commandments, which come next in chapter 20. No other gods before me, no idols to be cast. My name is holy, my day is holy. It's about the holiness of God. The law is about the holiness of God. All are part of this holy covenant that God gives us. And the covenant, God affirms it again as he did with Abraham. Look at Egypt. Look what I've done. Eagle's wings. All these things that God says to Moses, tell the people, if they obey me, if they enter into the covenant with me, this is what they will have. They will have my loving protection. They will have my guidance. They will have my presence with them. I will be with them. I will be their God, and they will be my people. And so the people all responded to this together in verse 8. The people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. They were on board in the beginning, but we know what happened. They were easily discouraged. They easily forgot. And all the rest of the Old Testament is God putting up with faithless people going back and forth. They could have believed and held on to the holiness of God, but they could have done what God told them to do. God told them to consecrate themselves. Consecration, that word that we use also in our doctrine, and we talk about the importance of consecration. That's our part of it. God sanctifies us when we give ourselves to Him completely and consecrate ourselves to Him, and we offer ourselves as living sacrifices. God does something. In this case, this was the beginning. They were to wash their clothes. They were to be careful not to go up on the mountain until they were told to do so. They were to listen for the ram's horn. They were to have no sexual relations during this time. They were to be in this special mode of thinking about and giving themselves to who God was and the holiness of God. And so God tells them to consecrate themselves. And then finally tonight, we've got to look at what happened when they did. They did consecrate themselves. They did all this. And what happened? God did what He said He would do. God came. Look at verse 16. Just reading verse 16 and following is an amazing description of what God did. Verse 16 says, on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Whew. This is an early picture of the holiness of God. Billowing smoke coming out of the mountain and violent shaking. They could all feel it down in the valley floor. The loud trumpet. And then the voice of God. And boy, how did the people tremble. Just imagine what it was like to be there. Imagine if you could, for another minute or two tonight, what it was like to be there at the base of Mount Sinai when God came down that first time, or at least in this context. They knew He said He would come, and then He did. The fire, the power, and the smoke, the violent shaking, and the loud trumpet, and the voice of God. God came. He did exactly what He said. And then He gave them the law through Moses, the presence of God. Mount Sinai is an incredible place. It's a incredible place to think about who God is, the holiness of God, how God is beginning to reveal Himself. Let's pray.